Who's that? He's our baby. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamore. Today, we're talking about the 2020 film, I'm Your Woman. The film stars Rachel Bosnahan, Arinze Kene, Marsha Stephanie Blake, Bill Heck, Frankie Faison, and Marceline Hugo. Julia Hart directed the film. She also directed Miss Stevens and Fast Color. Julia wrote the film with Jordan Horowitz. Jordan is a prolific producer as well as writer. He produced La La Land, among many other films. The film holds an 81% on Rotten Tomatoes. Quickly before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. And if you want to choose an upcoming episode of the show, click on support this podcast in the show description and support the show, and we can figure out a movie of your choosing that we both love. My guest today is Bart Lipton. Bart is a producer, line producer, unit production manager, and he's worked in those capacities on films like La La Land, Molly's Game, and John Wick Chapter 3. Welcome, Bart.
Hello. Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So my background is that I'm a screenwriter, but I'm also a former development executive. And we had the same line producer, unit production manager on almost every film that I made. Her name is Tara Cowell Plain. She's done like 70 movies. Shout out to Tara if she ever listens to this. And basically what our relationship was I would develop a script for the company. And by the time we had packaged it and financed it, and it looks like we're going into production, Tara and I would do these kind of back and forths where it would be like, can the five horses be two horses? Do we really need the church? Like, can this 25 extras be like seven extras and stuff like that? So I'm very familiar with the position when, as it pertains to wrangling the budget, but can you just tell the audience, for anyone who doesn't know, what a line producer or unit production manager does?
Sure. Although you did a very good synopsis of some of the general challenges of creative versus business. But my job is, I think, most easily described as I'm responsible for what is just off frame. Director is responsible what's on frame. So I'm, dealing with, all the crew and the locations and, basically it's two parts. It's the scheduling and hiring of the entire project start to finish. And then it's the budgeting of the entire project start to finish. And while it is a constant battle of expansion and reduction with the various departments and the directors and other, or the director and other producers, I try to strike a creative balance where I'm not perceived as the bad guy. Yeah. I would prefer to be perceived as a partner in right. helping make it all fit into the space that the director wants to work in.
Yeah, it's such a critical part of the process. And I think especially for people who maybe are purely on the creative side, or maybe just writers, or maybe are earlier in their careers, don't necessarily understand fully your job, but your job is so important. It was really interesting for this movie, and we're going to talk about some of the sort of logistical challenges of making this movie, which has some very particular challenges to it. So it starts with Jean, who's played by Rachel Brosnahan. She's a housewife in the late 1970s. She's married to Eddie, who's a criminal. They can't have children. They have never been able to adopt. Eddie just randomly brings home a baby boy for Jean to raise. And then not long after that, she's woken up in the middle of the night. One of Eddie's guys has come in. He tells her she's got to go on the run. He gives her over to this other guy whose name is Cal, and Cal says he's going to help her. She learns from Cal Eddie has gone missing. Everybody's looking for him, and he relocates Jean, which is Rachel's character, and her baby Harry to a new house. So this is the essential premise of the film. A mob housewife goes on the run with an adopted baby. Obviously, you have a previous relationship with Jordan Horowitz from La La Land. So I was curious, at what point did you get brought onto this project, and do you have a sense of how the story originated?
I was brought on to the project probably 6 months before it really started happening with Amazon. I had worked with Jordan previously on La La Land, and we had stayed in touch. I almost was involved in Fast Color, but was involved in a different project. And Jordan and I are good friends, and I really respect him and his POV as a producer. He has put in a lot of years in kind of getting to where he is, and La La Land really, was a great chance for him to do something really splashy. And I think that most people know Jordan through that moment of standing on stage at the Oscars. And we've talked about this moment a couple of times where, you know, he was the one correcting the award. He's holding the Oscar and he says, no, there's been a mistake. Moonlight won. And you know, that was a really pivotal moment. I don't know how many hundreds of millions of people were watching that, but to keep that calm and confidence at the same time. And like, no, it's not us. It's these other filmmakers.
Incredible moment. It's going to be on like a picture of it is going to be on his tombstone or something. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, of course, we had made the movie a year or so prior to that. And so I had a lot of respect for him anyway. But at that moment, it really kind of cemented, you know, just at least what I thought of him. So anyway, cut to the chase. He and his partner, Julia, had started making films when Julia transitioned from being a teacher into being a writer and then subsequently a director. And he kind of kept me posted on what was happening with her career. And I watched her films as she was making them. Miss Stevens is an amazing film. It was made for less than $1 million. It has Timothy Chalamet in it, and it's a great film. And I think that that was a calling card to allow the two of them to, you know, explore different genres and things like that. But anyway, when I first became aware of the project, Rachel Brosnahan had been talking to Julia about, you know, trying to do a film together. Mm-hmm. And Julia had had this story for I'm Your Woman that's in the 70s and was inspired by like Michael Mann's film Thief. Mm. And just as far as tonally, there were a lot of things going on there that Julia responded to. And she really thought that the 70s, like kind of crime genre was being underrepresented from a female perspective. So she wrote a script that Rachel Brosnahan is in literally every single scene of that movie. Yeah. And it's really her, you know, it's really her story. Of course, it's Jean's story, but you know, I can't give enough credit to Julia for really pushing it forward. It was a tough project to get off the ground, but she and Jordan are great partners, and they're a great team on set. The way they work with each other, it's tricky. Like, you know, they're husband and wife, but they're also, you know, they're also professional partners, and you know, not many people can do that. Yeah. Where you have your daytime relationship and your nighttime relationship with the same person, you know, and it's hard. I've worked with other husband and wife teams as well, and you know, they're just wired differently. But the story, I was really attracted to it from the very start, from Julia's point of view, and ultimately Jean's point of view. It was something I hadn't really seen before, and I was really happy with the way she told the story.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, so, you know, moving forward in the plot, Jean struggles with loneliness. She's in this new house with the baby. Mm-hmm. And that leads to a lot of scenes that, again, we just don't see that much, which is basically just her with this baby. And I mean, so one of our listeners, Ginger, will be happy we did this on the show. She had kind of talked to me about it, like, this is like number two baby performance of all time or something. Like, this is, it's unbelievable. I can't explain in words to the audience. Like, you have to watch the movie, but just to give you an example, there's a moment in this movie where Jean is laying on the bed and it's an overhead shot and the baby is next to her and the baby is looking at her and she's looking away. Then she turns to look at the baby and the baby responds to her doing that by reaching for her, which I have a 3-month-old son in the house right now. That's impossible. There's no way that you can't train a baby. But when you watch it, you almost feel like the baby is an actor. Like the baby, you're yelling cut and the baby's going to go smoke a cigarette or something. It's just incredible. And I have no idea how you did it.
It was not without a lot of agonizing preparation, because as you can imagine from a studio's point of view, where this baby is in a lot of scenes, and can, you know, could send things sideways at any moment. We had to really make sure that we had plan A, plan B, plan C, and even, you know, more backup plans should our initial plans fail. And basically, you know, we cast for twins.
Right.
We found twins that were amazing. And, you know, Julia is a mom as well. They have, she and Jordan have two kids. And so, you know, she was very sensitive from a mother's point of view about shooting, working with young children on set. You know, we need, there's certain hours, of course, that we have to be respectful of, and we don't want the kids to be overworked. We don't, you know, we're dealing with their parents off set, things like that. But so we had our two hero twins, and we were limited by the hours we could work with them. And then we had a backup set of twins as well that we had to have around in case things went totally sideways. And then after that, we made what we call fondly a fake baby, which was a super creepy, lifelike, actual size latex baby that looks remarkably similar to our hero twins. And so, like, we would just work our way down the list, depending on what was happening in a scene. And, you know, the babies, you know, we shot whatever, 36 days, I think, and the babies were on camera 19, maybe something like that. And every day, you know, depending on what the child had for breakfast that morning or how they slept the night before, you didn't know what was going to happen. And so we had to pivot quickly. But the two hero babies were amazing. And the moments you see on camera, of course, those were the best of the best.
Yeah.
And we knew, like, you know, we're shooting with them and just waiting for certain things to happen. And, like, you know, there's probably like four key moments in the movie that are kind of magical in that regard.
Yes, totally.
They're like the reaction that you're talking about, that it just happened. It's certainly not directed.
Right.
But you're creating a space where that kind of thing could happen, and that we could react to it, and that Rachel could react to it.
Yeah.
But everyone was freaked out, you know, when we're making it. We're like, what if the babies are crying all the time? What are you gonna do? What if the babies get sick? You know, we were shooting in winter the last couple of weeks of the movie, and like in that cabin, that was a real cabin. And it's like, it's lower than 20 degrees outside. Yeah. And it's like, how do you like work with a 6 month old in these conditions?
Incredible. So, that's absolutely, you know, incredible.
It was a lot of our preparation. Yeah,
I'm sure. So Jean ends up being befriended by her neighbor, Evelyn. And then there is this bit with Evelyn that is incredible. So when she befriends her, she says, hey, you know, my friends lived in that house for years. And it's so nice to see somebody else living there or whatever. And then they end up having like dinner. And Evelyn says, oh, where's the bathroom? And Jean like kind of takes a beat. And she's like, wait, didn't your friends live here for years? And Evelyn's like, oh yeah, they did. And it felt, you know, I thought a lot watching this movie about Godfather 2. Godfather 2, one of the things that makes it so, you know, you can revisit it so many times is that it's so subtle. It's so ambiguous. There's things about it where you can watch the movie 20 times. You're still not sure. And this moment, the ambiguity of it was so effective because Evelyn goes off to go to the bathroom. And I 100% would have believed it if she came back with a gun. But I also 100% believe it that she's just kind of a confused older woman. And I was wondering if that, like, was that Godfather 2 a specific influence on this movie, on the creative side of this movie?
You know, I can't speak for Julia in that regard. I have not heard that reference, but I mean, I appreciate the parallels that you talked about just then. We shot that scene a number of different ways. Mm. And, you know, it was an editing decision, you know, clearly performance wise for Julia. And, you know, there, the actress gave a range of, a range to her performance. One was more like scary, one was more ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And you know, versions in between, that kind of thing. And, you know, the interesting thing about this movie is I think that the pacing is really different because it's so inside of Gene's head that I think they did a really nice job stringing out the story and the different beats and what the psychological implications were, and using the pacing to kind of leverage those feelings so that you were, you know, inside Gene's head. But, you know, as far as the Godfather 2 reference, I had not heard that, but I know that there's for sure a half dozen different ways that Julia could have gone with that scene based on the material that she had.
And it's so critical, because what comes after that is that Jean realizes her home has been broken into. She calls this number that Cal gave her. She goes over to Evelyn's house. She finds Eddie's former associates. They've tied Evelyn up, gagged her. Cal arrives to and rescues Jean and Harry by killing everybody. And he also kills Evelyn, the old lady. And when they're driving away, Jean is sort of aghast about it. And obviously, it's a very bold choice for the story. But it's almost one of those things where, like, it's the audience, you just don't know. You don't have the answer necessarily if she was innocent or if she did tell them where Jean was or what. Do you, like, for you as somebody working on the movie, do you have an answer, or does that evolve for you over time?
An answer for why?
Like, was she actually in on it? Did she tip them off? Hey, here's where Jean is. Or was she just an innocent old lady and she forgot where the bathroom was?
My take on it, and Jordan and Julia talked to me about this a little bit, but I never feel completely comfortable saying, like, hey, what did you mean on page 32? What does this mean exactly? Because I want to, you know, some of that it's up to the viewer to, you know, to connect those dots. But my impression of that was that the two bad guys had taken over Evelyn's house and kidnapped her, or you know, held her hostage or whatever, and they sent her out to get answers, you know, to what they wanted to know, right? Like they, and maybe, I don't know, maybe you hadn't considered this option. This is my take on it. And so, like, they were in her house and they sent her over, and she went back and reported. And it's like, you know, they're going to kill her unless she gets them the information that they want.
That is so interesting. Because if that's the case, because if that's the case, then that means their entire interaction was under the guise of that, which is so effed up. And it makes it even more sort of like, psychologically, man. Whew. Yeah,
right. Cool. So like Jean's suspicions are accurate, you know.
Yeah.
With that, like, you know, she has this intruder, she's welcomed this intruder into her house, and she's not sure, you know, why that person's there, but she's being very cautious, but she wants to be friendly. And at the same time, of course, exactly, the person's there trying to find out, you know, what's Jean doing, where's the baby, is there money hidden there? What's the deal, you know?
Yeah, that's fascinating. All right, so we're going to take a quick break for our sponsor. We are going to be right back with the back half of this movie. We'll be right back. Movies I Love That No One Talks About is brought to you by Virtual Pitch Fest. Virtual Pitch Fest is a trusted industry source that specializes in connecting screenwriters with production companies and representatives. With Virtual Pitch Fest, writers can search through an online database, almost like a dating site, to see what 500 plus participating companies are looking for. They can then send short written pitches on their scripts to chosen companies with the assurance of a guaranteed response back. That's right, guaranteed. You get an answer, you get a fair shot. That's a really critical difference with this service compared to some of the other online pitch services for writers. To date, site connections have led to 150 plus success stories, including produced films. There's actually a Bruce Willis, Megan Fox movie that was recently produced directly because of Virtual Pitch Fest. Just a writer who, you know, was relatively unknown, went on there, did a pitch. The pitch was picked up by a producer, and then that ended up becoming this movie. There's also been dozens of other script deals, many writers landing representation. If this sounds like something that could be useful to you, check out Virtual Pitch Fest at virtualpitchfest.com. Okay, we are back. So Cal relocates Jean and Harry to this remote cabin and reveals that Eddie was part of this crime syndicate and murdered his boss, which plunged the city into anarchy. Jean says Eddie would never kill anyone. And Cal calmly replies, "Eddie's a killer, Jean," which is just such a great, really simple line of dialogue. It says so much. Jean is eventually joined by Terry, Cal's wife, their son Paul, and Cal's father Art. She kind of pieces together that Terry was formerly married to Eddie, and now they're worried that Cal might be in trouble. They haven't seen him in a little bit. And so Jean says she's going to go with Terry. They're going to go back to the city and try to find Cal. They go to a nightclub. Gene gets lost during a shootout. And this movie, which has been so intimate, so quiet, a couple people in a room, suddenly becomes like, you know, it's like Carlito's Way or something. It's like this huge nightclub scene with like 200 extras. And it almost reminded me of like when we used to go to the movie theater, the when you would see an IMAX movie and they would cut to like the IMAX section and the screen would sort of like get bigger. It was almost felt like that watching the movie because like the canvas of the story kind of expands. And at the end of this big sequence, we see what looked to me like, you know, maybe 125 extras running out of this nightclub through period cars on this big street. That one shot probably cost more than like some entire movies I've made. So I was just, I wanted to know for you, like to plan and execute a scene like that, what does your life look like making that happen?
That's a great question and great analysis of what that scene meant to the movie, and it did really expand the scope of it when we came to it. So, you know, that scene was very complicated. Of course, you know, being in a club with you know, 100 and, you know, whatever, it was around 125, like you said, period extras that all have to be costumed, et cetera, et cetera, in the middle of November in Pittsburgh. Where it was at one point, I think it was 8 degrees outside. So, you know, we had limited time to work on this particular street. Pittsburgh's a beautiful city. I've worked there a couple of times and it's like a time capsule out of the 1970s. Mm. And so we found this one really great kind of historical area of I forget the name of the street, but it lined up perfectly where we could get every 1970s car we could find out and just stretch it all the way down, you know, for 5 or 6 blocks. And when we were working inside, it took, I think, 3 days to shoot that sequence, but particularly the chaos was actually pretty elaborately choreographed. Yeah. Because again, we're with Jean the whole time and the camera's following her. She's crawling on the ground and going through, you know, trying to escape the gunfire and, you know, the chaos that's going on there. You know, all those extras, of course, you know, they're all being paid for their work. And, you know, this was like a 12 or 14 hour day. When we're shooting outside on the street, we have businesses up and down the street that, you know, we have to make appear like it's the 1970s, you know. Right. You have to turn all the TVs off. You have to turn all the displays off. It's, you know, we put neon up in a number of places. And, you know, we had a couple of large cranes working there just to add scope to some of the shots, particularly the one where she runs along the side of the building and, you know, she comes upon or she goes past the entrance or the exit to the club. And there's, you know, dozens and dozens of people just running out screaming. Yeah. As the traffic backs up on the street. And I would say the hardest part of that particular scene was, you know, getting the city to allow us to shoot there. You know, because it affected several dozen businesses and, you know, obviously closed off traffic. Mm. And, you know, we had a lot of police officers that we had to deal with, and it was super, super cold. But, you know, we shot that big exterior shot probably 8 times. And I think the last one was around 3 a.m. Wow. And it was literally the last one that we did that was where everything came together. Mm. You know, we were trying to be really efficient. Julia and Jordan are very smart and like they don't want to shoot a scene 30 times if it's not necessary, but they're going to go after it until they get, you know, until they get what's right. And it was a great scene, a great showpiece, and, you know, a shot and a scene that a lot of people call out as, you know, being, you know, visually, you know, really, really exciting.
Yeah, it's a real showstopper for the movie. So Gene, after kind of all this chaos and stuff, Gene goes and cries in a laundromat and two women who she does not know comfort her, which is such a, again, it's such a really clever little moment of like, she's being mothered after she has been the mother for so much of the story. She learns more about Terry and Eddie's past life. She learns that Paul is actually Eddie's son. So even something like that, there's so much you can read into it because she has a kid that's not hers. And that Eddie just gave her. And then Eddie had this whole secret life away from her where he was probably his more authentic self and had a biological child. And she didn't know him. She didn't really know who he was. So, you know, it's like, there's just so many layers to it. For you, like, was this a movie where you read the script the first time, then it's like, okay, now we're shooting it. then you watch it, and each kind of step along the way, were there sort of like a surprising depths to it that you found in being immersed in it for so long?
Trying to think of the best way to answer this. So I recognized early on that Julia had a very specific point of view, and particularly like the moments that you're talking about, the laundromat and other places too. It has in the midst of this, in the midst of the story, a very soft and gentle touch that I think only could have come from Julia. And, you know, she worked so closely with Rachel to develop Rachel's arc and develop all the characters, you know, that Rachel comes in contact with. I knew when we were shooting that it was going to have the tone that ultimately it did. But you know, a lot of things can go sideways in the edit room. You just don't know sometimes when you're shooting it how it's all going to look. But everyone felt on set. I mean, we had amazing cinematographer Bryce Fortner. He was fantastic. He had worked with Julian Jordan previously, and we could see on the monitors. We knew what the tone was going to be and what the emotional weight of these scenes was going to be. When I saw it on set, it was very, very similar to the way it looks in the final film. Sometimes, you know, you process the imagery so much between the time when you shoot it and the time, you know, ultimately when it gets through post-production, that it can look completely different. But this was, it looked as beautiful on set as it did in the final piece. And the story beats that are so emotionally strong in the final film, they are that way on the page as well. Yeah.
So that kind of answers my next question, which was going to be, you know, basically we go from there. Jean finds her way to the safe house hotel. She's reunited with Terry and Cal. They find out that, you know, Eddie's dead. They're going to leave the city. Eddie's rival, Mike, crashes into their car, abducts Jean, threatens her. She ends up shooting him. Terry had given her a gun. She returns to the scene of the accident, rescues Terry and Cal. And, you know, I think that to your point, like that question of the things playing on set the way that they would play in the final film, what's interesting about the movie is that when I first heard about the movie and then when I saw the art, I 100% thought this was going to be Rachel becomes like female Michael Corleone or something, and with the gun, and she's going to be going around shooting people. The movie's not like that at all. It's very minimalist. And the moments of action are really well executed, but the emotional story has to be equally well executed. Otherwise, the movie would not work. So they return to the cabin and they find Mike's men and Art, and they're dead in a shootout, but Paul and Harry are still alive. And then we get one of those moments that you talked about before with the baby, where they open up the hiding space and Paul is there, and he was so tired that he kind of slumped over and fell asleep, but he's still holding on to the baby. And the baby looks up at Jean and he gives her this look like, hey, you know, like, good to see you. And it's just like, again, the baby acting, just unreal. And then they all kind of just like reunite with the kids and drive off. And that's the end of the movie. And so my last question is, I want to talk about how we quantify how these movies now are released, right? Because it's so different than it used to be. It used to be you could kind of look at the numbers and you sort of knew, okay, well, this is what it did in the box office. And now it's almost a strange thing where like these movies come out, and at least for me, like I don't know how you quantify their success or failure or how many people are watching them or what. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to do the movie on the show is that I felt like I hadn't heard enough people talking about it. But then on the flip side, I mentioned that I was doing this, and my mom, who is totally not the target audience, was like, oh yeah, I loved it. And I was like, Mom, you watch this? So how do you quantify, like, when a movie like this comes out, how do you quantify how much of the audience it reaches?
Oh, that's a great question. I've done a number of projects for Amazon, and so far they've all had, you know, some type of theatrical release. I'm Your Woman was a little bit different because, you know, it came out in December, and theatrical releases were very difficult then. And it was a different experience seeing that in the theater. I'm in Atlanta currently, and I got to go see it in a theater here in Atlanta. And it was such a different experience than seeing it streaming, which 99% of people they're going to see the movie this way.
Yeah.
And, you know, as far as how people perceive it, you know, people watch movies in different ways now. They typically don't watch them at home in complete chunks. you know, like they won't sit down and watch something great for 2 hours. And it's kind of, it kind of does a disservice to the storytellers because you don't control where, I mean, there's no commercial breaks. So you don't control when a person presses the pause button. You know, they could press it like, oh, don't stop now. 5 seconds from now, something, you know, is going to be happening that you need to understand and get your head wrapped around. So, you know, from a filmmaker standpoint, when they're making these kind of movies for, you know, for the streaming services, for Netflix and for Amazon, you know, I think the goal is they still have to make the best film they can make. And they just have to trust that if the viewer is attracted to the story, they're going to watch it and react to it accordingly. But I really think that still nothing has replaced the theatrical, experience to seeing the movie. Your question, it was a difficult question to answer. I don't know that I really answered it.
Well, I mean, you know, here's another thing I would ask. So with Amazon, because obviously these streaming services are famously sort of tight-lipped about like how many people watch stuff. They pretty much only tell you if it's been like a massive success.
Yeah.
And I know that Amazon, from what I understand, when it's an Amazon film, they're basically paying you out saying like, hey, here's the money you would have gotten if it had done well in theaters, like on the back end, we're just going to give it to you up front. Do they even have to tell you like the exact numbers? Like, is that something that the filmmakers actually get of like how many people watched it? And
I get a better sense of this now. I am not told. I don't get the information of like, okay, X number of million, you know, downloads or streams happened on this film. Amazon doesn't do that. Do they tell, it's possible that they tell Julian Jordan that information. Maybe they know that, but I'm thinking they probably don't.
Yeah.
The only quantifier that I've seen in the marketplace is that Netflix does like, hey, here are the top 10 shows that people are streaming now. You know, which, you know, if we believe what they're saying, it's based on the number of views, unless there's some ulterior motive going on there. I don't know. It's difficult. It's kind of making a movie for, in some ways, like a black hole. You know, you hate putting it up there, and then you're counting on reviewers and critics to give a good word of mouth. And then you hope that people are watching it at home, but it's possible that they're not. I mean, I did a film for Amazon a couple of years ago called Last Flag Flying. That it was a Rick Linklater film.
Yeah.
And it had, you know, virtually no theatrical release. It's a great movie, but there was very little press done on it. And we just like, we don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know like how many people have watched it. Anytime someone says to me, hey, I saw Last Flag Flying, it was great. And I say, congratulations, you are the seventh person to see that movie. I just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is why I wanted to do this movie on the show, because this is a truly excellent movie. And I also worry that it's exactly the kind of movie that can sort of slip through the cracks in our new fangled distribution system. I really encourage anybody who has not seen it to go watch it, because I think it's truly excellent.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a great, chance for Rachel Brosnahan to expand with her fans and to get new fans, to expand her kind of universe of talents, because she's so just connected to the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel character, rightly so. I mean, she's done that, you know, she's done that really well for, you know, three seasons, soon to be four. And this was a great extension of that character. It's a period film, but it's a completely different take on a female lead. And you know, I think a lot of people who were fans of Mrs. Maisel saw this and looked at her completely differently afterwards. She's a great actress.
Yeah, it's an excellent point, because my wife loves Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I've never watched it, and because of watching this movie, now I'm a fan of Rachel as an actress. And this movie is like the Venn diagram of me and my wife. Like, this is a movie that we could actually watch together and both get something out of it. I do think it's a perfect way for her to expand her audience, for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that is our time. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. Please consider giving us a 5-star review on iTunes if you enjoy the show, which helps people discover the show. I want to thank my guest, Bart Lipton. Until next time, bye-bye.